And welcome to a special edition of Anti-Psychiatry Radio. This is your proud anti-psychiatry host and producer of Anti-Psychiatry on CKLN 88.1 FM. And this, we are bringing you a special edition of Word of Mouth through Anti-Psychiatry Radio. And we have a excellent lineup tonight. We have one solid hour, friends, but before we get to some, I'll be talking with two psychiatric survivors sisters shortly. One is Loretta Wilson in Loretta Wilson in Michigan. A proud psychiatric survivor activist against electroshock, and a good friend, artist, author, psychiatric survivor, editor, Irit Shimrat in Vancouver. And, of course, we'll have music. But first we have the headlines. Okay, with Susie and Shatila.
It's actually Shital, but thanks, Don, for the introduction. And the headlines tonight are brought to you in part by Democracy Now! And various other independent news sources. And, of course, they're compiled by Shital Ludia, who's one of our newest crew members here on Friday Word of Mouth News. And we begin in Libya, where many international organizations have been hindered in their attempts to provide aid to those fleeing the conflict. Aid workers are unable to enter the country and have been limited to treat the injured, weak, and sick along the border with Libya. Those few relief workers who have made through the border have become targets of army brutality and have been subjected to mock executions before being released. Meanwhile, food and supply shortages have become more acute and widespread. Over 200,000 people have fled Libya so far, most of them migrant workers, many of whom fled unrest in their own countries, only to meet with it in Libya. Meanwhile, the Gaddafi regime has intensified its assault to retake rebel-controlled towns. Clashes are raging in the key oil port city of Ras Lanuf after dozens of pro-Gaddafi forces landed by boat. The regime appears to have taken full control of the towns of Sawiya after fighting that reportedly left scores of civilians dead. In an interview, Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, vowed to crush the rebellion even if it receives foreign backing.
In women-focused news, the United Nations Rapid Response four-person team is headed to the Democratic Republic of Congo as part of its mission to work in zones experiencing mass outbreaks of sexual violence. The team is headed by Innocent Zahinda and will only be deployed to countries where governments issue an official invitation. The team works under the supervision of Margot Wallström, the UN Special Representative for Sexual Violence and Conflict, and was the result of partial implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1888, which was approved in September 2009. Innocent Zahinda recently warned that given the scale of the conflict zones, sex assaults, the four-person unit, with two positions yet to be filled, may not be able to respond to every incident of mass rape. Zahinda also explained that in order to work effectively and properly train officials and other staff working on the ground, the team needs to be issued an official invitation good enough for a two-month work stay.
In Zimbabwe, 45 people, including 11 women, were held in prison for over 2 weeks for gathering at a political meeting to watch news clips of the uprising in North Africa. On Monday, the group facing treason charges was narrowed to six. President Mugabe's security forces rounded up the group of 45 while they were gathered in an office building for a meeting organized by the International Socialist Organization to meet and watch recordings of the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt. On Monday, 39 of the accused were released and allowed to return home. Six remaining, including one woman, now await a trial date at the High Court on treason charges, which carry the death sentence in Zimbabwe.
In the U.S., despite weeks of protests in Madison, Wisconsin, the Republicans have gone ahead with their plan to curb the union rights of public workers. Governor Scott Walker has stated that he will sign the bill quickly to seal the law. The Republican Stacked Assembly voted 53-42 to approve the bill after 3 hours of debate, with all but four votes in favor of said bill. Yesterday, more than 1,000 people staged class walkouts in Madison, at the University of Madison. City firefighters urged for a boycott of banks with ties to Governor Walker, and thousands of demonstrators protested outside the Wisconsin State Capitol building after the vote. Petitions and other forms of recourse, including sleep-ins, have already begun to recall the Republican senators who voted in favor of the bill. Many feel that the voting process itself was suspicious and did not follow due process, happening by surprise and in the middle of the night over a 30-minute period. The state Senate had been at a standstill after all 14 Democratic members fled the Senate to prevent quorum, but Republicans advanced the measure by requiring only a 20-member quorum for action.
Also in the U.S., the parents of 6-year-old Alisa Thomas recently discovered that their daughter is on the U.S. government's no-fly list when they tried to make a flight from Cleveland to Minneapolis. According to the U.S. Transportation Security Administration, the watch lists are an important layer of security to prevent individuals with known or suspected ties to terrorism from flying. After contacting the Department of Homeland Security, the Thomas family was unable to gather more information and received instead a letter addressed to 6-year-old Alisa stating that nothing in her file will be changed.
Following the massive tsunami that hit Japan, Canada's west coast has been put on alert. Flight delays and cancellations are in effect, with warnings along the Pacific coast for Alaska, British Columbia, Sydney, Australia, and Hawaii. The tsunami struck Japan's northern coastline following a devastating 8.9 magnitude earthquake, one of the strongest ever recorded. At least 220 people have been killed, but the death toll is expected to rise significantly. The Japanese government has declared a nuclear emergency. At least 2,000 residents near the Fukushima nuclear power plant have been evacuated from their homes after the cooling system at the plant failed. The Japanese government says it has deactivated 11 of the nation's 55 nuclear plants. A tsunami warning has been issued for nearly the entire Pacific Ocean basin, which includes Canada's west coast.
And in Women's Center News, in Canada, a report released by the YWCA states that the gender gap has closed in employment numbers and reversed in education without a corresponding social policy response. The report entitled Educated, Employed, and Equal stresses that Canada needs, quote, early learning and childcare services, not a social policy gap that is decades behind reality, unquote. The report goes on to say that despite what amounts to a social revolution in the lives of women since 1970, with an employment rate increase for women with children under the age of 3 years of 233%, early learning and childcare services remain an inadequate patchwork that does not offer choice. Paulette Senior, YWCA's Canada CEO, explained, quote, the federal government is acting as if women are still at home instead of providing support for working mothers, unquote. The report concludes by stating that early learning and childcare services are essential to Canadian prosperity, a crucial support for children and parents, and should become as normalized in our social structure as the public school system.
In Ottawa, the Speaker of Canada's House of Commons, Peter Milliken, has found that Stephen Harper's government has abused its power. Harper stated in response, quote, you win some, you lose some, end quote. The Speaker has been pressing the Prime Minister to account for all his actions and to be more transparent in his operations, yet Harper continues to demonstrate the opposite. For example, recently Immigration Minister Jason Kenney is under scrutiny after a letter from his office was sent seeking donations to pay for a partisan ad campaign. Moreover, Harper has made moves to rebrand the Government of Canada as, quote, the Harper government, end quote, and has yet to properly account for the $500,000 severance package given to former ethics watchdog Christine Ouimet.
And we finish with a headline in Toronto. Mayor Rob Ford has promised a fresh start for the Toronto Community Housing Corporation after reports of scandalous spending and exorbitant personal expenses by the former board. Former City Councillor Case Oates has been appointed solo interim director of the TCHC until a new board is established. Many have been outraged because Ford has not followed due process in sweeping the board before giving each member a formal hearing, especially given that two of the board's members were tenant-elected representatives. All of these actions are part of Ford's larger plan to cut city spending through privatization of formerly public bodies. Interim Director Oates himself is not opposed to privatizing the TCHC and argues that, quote, "we certainly need to look at all options," unquote.
And now we have a few community announcements, four of them. Tomorrow, Saturday, March the 12th, come to the rally, join the march, and visit with the fair. Come out and mark International Women's Day March, beginning at Bedford and Bloor, the University of Toronto's OISE building. The second announcement is for the Centre of Women's Studies in Education, CWSE, and Resources for Feminist Research, who present the launch of a new book called Becoming Feminists, an anthology of how we became feminist, on Wednesday, March 16th, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at CWSE, which is 252 Bloor Street West, second floor, room 225. The third announcement is for the Art for All Canada Art Conference, which is happening at Metro Hall in Toronto. It began on Saturday, March the 5th, and will continue until Saturday, March the 12th, tomorrow at 4 p.m. And our last community announcement is from CUPE, the Canadian Union of Public Employees. They'll be hosting a keynote address to a community forum with Wisconsin State AFL-CIO Treasurer Stephanie Bloomingdale on Monday, March the 14th from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. at the Toronto Sheraton Centre, 123 Queen Street West, Dominion Ballroom. This conference is to show how Wisconsin's experience mirrors events taking place here in Toronto and Ontario.
So come out to those events, and let's see you tomorrow at the march. We're going to go to a quick musical break, and we'll be back with more word-of-mouth news and Anti-Psychiatry Radio with Don Weitz.
Someone took my sunshine, stole my memories. Dark days inside my head are killing me. Can't play piano no more, don't know my family. Won't somebody please, please help me? Why is it mostly women? Violence by the state. Psychiatric nightmare. Electric shock. It's gonna stop. Someone took my soul, burned my memories. Turn my dreams to ashes, hurting me. How could this be helping by burning life away? Psychiatric nightmare, electric shock, electric shock. It's gonna stop. It's gonna stop.
And I'm back. Special edition for Women's Week, International Women's Week, I prefer to call it, not just International Women's Day, which is on the 8th, as everybody knows. This is Don White, your proud anti-psychiatry host, a very special one-hour-long version edition of Anti-Psychiatry Radio. What you just heard was the shock song, the anti-shock song, Roger Ellis, Juno Award winner, so winning songwriter and singer and busker, wrote, from what I understand, the only song that speaks out against the shocking, particularly of against women. Well, we've got a full lineup, friends, and I am dedicating this program to all my sisters, psychiatric survivor sisters, who are still fighting. And if you're not fighting, you're supporting our struggles to speak out against patriarchy, sexism, heterosexism, and ageism, and homophobia, which is rampant in the psychiatric system, just as it is in our general society. We're going to focus again on electroshock against women, and I just want to make some introductory remarks. For those of you who don't know, 15,000 people a year in Canada are being electroshocked. Over at least 10,000 are women. I don't have the exact source, but I will get it for you when later in another show, which we'll be talking about next month. Over 10,000 women being electroshocked. At least 55 or 60% of those are elderly over 60. I want to read some sexist facts to you in the administration, so-called neutral administration. I say that ironically. There's no neutral administration of electroshock in psychiatry. That's ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. These sexist facts were written, written by Dr. Bonnie Burstow, chair of the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, CAPA. And thank you very much, Bonnie, for making these facts available. Electroconvulsive therapy always damages the brain and causes memory loss, with some people never again being able to manage a job requiring complex thought and never again being able to remember their family and their children. Fact. 90% of all shock doctors are men. Fact. While it is standard to deny that ECT is brain damaging, early pioneering shock doctors were very clear that ECT was brain damaging. These people, quote, wrote psychiatrist and shock promoter Abraham Meyerson, quote, have more intelligence than they can handle, and the reduction of intelligence is an important factor in the curative process, close quote. Fact, throughout its history and in every single country where it is administered, women receive electroshock 2 to 3 times as often as men. Fact, ECT is now the treatment of choice for postpartum depression. Fact, women incur more damage from ECT than men do. Fact, women over 60 are singularly targeted for ECT and account for approximately half the treatments. This despite the fact that as extensive longitudinal research by Sackheim proves, elder women incur the most damage from the procedure. Fact, ECT has been appropriately named state-sponsored violence against women. If you want more scholarly article or for scholarly articles and studies, including feminist ones, which make visible this violence against women, see this website, friends. It's well worth your taking a close look. Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, oneword.com. Repeat, Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault.com. Now on the air, on the phone, I believe we have a sister, a very proud and active sister who's been speaking out recently this year and probably before against electroshock in the United States, particularly against women, and we will be talking with her, as a matter of fact, any second now, and which will include her very awesome initiatives to stop the electroshocking of 67-year-old Elizabeth Ellis. But first I want to greet Loretta Wilson. Are you there, Loretta?
Hi, Don.
Oh, welcome to Anti-Psychiatry Radio, CKLN, here in Toronto. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. I hope you're well tonight.
I am, and thank you for having me.
Good. I thought we'd start out, Loretta, to give our listeners a little background about some of your personal experiences as a shock survivor in Michigan, maybe getting into a little bit of background about what it was like, maybe about how many ECTs you had and how old and so forth when you got them.
Okay. Well, when I began, I actually began with drugs.
Yes.
I got started on the drugs in 1986 when my son turned 21. I had my third child, and he turned 21 and celebrated, and I was unhappy about that, and it put me into tears. Mm. Prior to that, though, I had had surgery back in 1974, and in 1976 went on what they called a little nerve pill, and it was called Atrophine. Hmm. I believe that's only available in Canada now.
What's it called?
At that point, things were, I was very active. I took classes in photography, became a photographer, even having five children at home.
Yes.
And then in 1993, things kind of broke loose, and I ended up in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And the doctor said that I was now drug resistant.
Were you forced into the hospital, or did you go voluntarily, Loretta?
They took me.
Pardon?
They took me.
Kicked you.
They took me from my home.
Oh, they took you from your forcibly.
They, yes, they took me from my home. I did not want to go.
Right.
And at that point, that's when I started the series of electroshocks. There were six of them. I was taken to a hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It was Pinerest Christian Hospital. Christian made me have trust in the hospital because of my Christian background.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it was showing all my records indicate repeatedly that I refused the treatment, but I still received it.
You were refusing it then when they took.
Yes, I was refusing the treatment.
Yes,
but they still gave it to me.
What was the reason they gave you for wanting to administer shock to you?
They had determined, the doctor determined, I was drug resistant and that I needed the treatments. And that would make me better.
Hmm.
I had the promise of being better. I didn't understand that the drugs were actually causing a lot of the problems I was experiencing.
Yes.
The side effects were horrendous.
I'm sure they are, as they are for many other women. Now, did they explain anything about the ECT procedure, or that you had the right to refuse, or that there were any alternatives to electroshock at that time?
There were no alternatives.
So,
and as far as detailed, being able to give detail on what they told me. I have no recall on that other than I was simply told to sign the form so they could bill the insurance company. And the form was a form for surgery.
Hmm.
The procedure was ECT.
Yeah. Now, can you just briefly mention some of the major effects that the series of six, I guess you had at least six, have had on your life?
Personal relationships have been destroyed.
Hmm.
People walk away from these circumstances, walk away from me. The memory is really a big problem.
Yes.
And it has continued to be a problem.
Yeah.
And I have really basically no stories to reminisce and tell my kids about when they were growing up. I don't have any of their birthdays, special events, Christmases, weddings. I can't tell them anything about when they were born.
These are your own children.
I have pictures. I don't have any stories to go with the pictures. It took my memory, much of my memory. And then during the time of the shock treatment, I was also drugged. I was drugged before. I was drugged during. And I was still. I continued to be drugged afterward. And so that I didn't have the ability to form new memories.
Yes.
So it...
And this was how long ago? Now, it was in the 90s, 1990s or 1980s of the Jews?
In 1993 was the first series. There were six of them.
Six, and you're still having some difficulties remembering. This is 17, well, 18 years later.
If you, in 1997, they started the treatments again.
Yes.
And through 1997.
Yes.
1999.
Right.
And 2000. And during that period of time, there were a minimum of 54 shocks administered.
How many?
54.
54.
Yes, 50. Yes.
That is horrendous. Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's a damn crime that's a crime that they committed against you and are still committing against thousands and thousands of women, like Elizabeth Ellis. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about your and other people's, including David Oakes, but I would want to focus on some of your efforts around Elizabeth Ellis, around the Elizabeth Ellis case. I should just briefly mention to our listeners that for bad background, Elizabeth Ellis is a 67-year-old woman. She has a career as a counselor, a teacher in Minnesota, and she is currently locked up against her will and being threatened or forced with another series of electroshocks when they wanted to give her an electroshock as an outpatient. I believe this is correct. Please jump in, Loretta, if I'm missing some facts here. This is just brief background. That she refused another attempt to administer electroshock to her, at which time the court soon thereafter ordered her to be electroshocked, and she is being locked up because she has refused.
Yes, she went for one treatment in January because it was ordered, and then the second one she refused and had contacted Mind Freedom International, and then when she refused, then early in February, she was notified that they were going to pick her up.
Yeah.
And she lived a couple of days in the terror of the idea that they were going to come after her.
Yes.
And then they did pick her up, and it took us a little while to find her and learn that she had been taken to Fergus Falls in Minnesota.
Right.
And we've contacted the governor, numerous contacts with the governor, her state representatives, senators, mental health providers. No one has given us any hope of, they're not talking. They're remaining silent.
Yeah, can you briefly tell what you, I think you wrote to the governor, I think it's Governor Dayton, somebody like that?
Yeah.
Mark Dayton of Minnesota. Can you briefly just summarize what you wrote him and what you are urging others to do, whether it's writing or doing something else in order to free Elizabeth?
What I had done is I did contact the governor. And I pleaded with him to, because of my own experience and my own fear of electroshock, mm-hmm. I know I understand why Elizabeth has chose to be silent. He has not responded to any of my communication, whether by phone or email or letter, and he... There just is no response.
Yeah, he hasn't responded to me and many others either to our
Correct.
Letters. So he's trying to give us the silent treatment.
Well, you know, what I find interesting about this as far as silence is concerned is that while it appears quite appropriate for the elected government officials to remain silent, Elizabeth risks being considered catatonic because of her decision to exercise her legal right to remain silent.
Yes, well, there's your double standard, huh?
Exactly.
It's okay for the politicians to keep their mouths shut and not say anything, right? Which we have going on here. There's a conspiracy of silence here by the media and in Ottawa, the federal government. But it's not okay if a psychiatric survivor, someone being threatened, chooses to remain silent, which is their, as you know, their constitutional right.
Right.
So in a minute or so that we have, or two, can you, a couple more minutes we have, could talk about some of the, what you expect or what you are hoping for in the as a result of people speaking out and in many ways not speaking out for Elizabeth.
In my opinion, Elizabeth represents Elizabeth all over the world, and I believe that because of this situation with Elizabeth, we definitely have to move forward in our campaign to bring about change in the mental health system, to call a halt to this travesty, this heinous crime.
Yes, I totally agree.
It's brutal. According to a woman I talked with yesterday, she said that it is brutal. And that the treatment is far worse than the so-called disease. Another said that it was terrifying, and she was so afraid that she would actually lose it and not be able to remember that she's a Christian.
Yes.
It was. She lived the constant terror and shook. With her body would shake from the fear. Every time that she would have to walk into that room.
Yes. Well, this is what I've always thought of, and I'm not alone in this, that this is one of the main objectives of forced psychiatric treatment, such as electroshock, to induce fear. To induce fear and silence. We'll have to wrap up now, but listen, I would like you... Very, very, first of all, I want to thank you very, very much. And you know, we are with you 1,000% here, Loretta, that here, not only at the radio station here, but in other survivor, psychiatric survivor groups, we are speaking to more and more people here. And I hope more women who are the main targets are going to speak out more and more. Especially when we have our Mother's Day event on May 7th. And I thank you very, very much for sending us a good, strong statement. So I wish you a lot of good, and just know that you have our support, and we will continue to speak out, and fight for the freedom, other human rights of Elizabeth Ellis and other women, for sure.
Right, for sure. I really appreciate the time that you've given to this and your comments, and it means so much. It's very important to have this support.
Right, and thank you, and the best to other sisters and brothers who are fighting like yourself, and we'll be in touch again.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I was just speaking with Loretta Wilson in Michigan, I believe it's near Flint, but I should know. Anyway, one of the several activists who are organizing some resistance on behalf of 67-year-old Elizabeth Ellis, currently locked up in a psycho prison in Anoka, Minnesota. And we are going to take a break. Musical break.
See trees of green, red roses too. Oh, well, I've seen them blue for me and for you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I've seen skies of blue and clouds of white. It's a bright, pleasant day. It's a dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, I think to myself, what a wonderful world. And the colors of the rainbow are so pretty in the sky. And they're also the faces of the people passing by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? But really they're saying, I love you.
And we're back. Thank you, Mark. Through his technical wizardry, we heard What a Wonderful World, sung by, recorded by Ron Lee Tepper's Lip Liners, I believe. That is quite an original, a unique name of a band I haven't heard of. But then again, I haven't heard of a lot of great bands. Anyway, this, again, we're back. This is another special International Women's Week program of Anti-Psychiatry Radio on Word of Mouth. And this is a special edition featuring psychiatric survivors once again speaking out. I just was, some of you heard, talking with Elizabeth, Loretta Wilson in Michigan. And now on the line, I do have Irit Shimrad. Irit, are you there? I hope she's there. Irit Shimrad. Oh, something happened. Please bear with us. We have a little technical difficulty, which I'm sure will be cleared up. Irit Shimrad is not just a good friend, but she is a former editor of the only anti-psychiatry magazine in Canada that lasted for 10 years, Phoenix Rising, the author of Call Me Crazy, True Stories of the Mad Movement, that was published, I believe, in 1997, if I'm not mistaken. A very rich collection of personal stories by psychiatric survivors in Canada. We are trying to get Irit in Vancouver, and please don't touch that dial, friends. You're tuned to 88.1 FM CKLN 88.1 FM, and we're Arit, should be there. Arit, are you there?
Yes, hello, Dawn.
Oh, what a, it's wonderful to hear your voice on CKLN. Welcome. And
thank you. It's wonderful to be on CKLN.
Yes.
Go CKLN.
Right. Thanks for agreeing to the interview. First, I would like to just to mention that, and please correct me for anything about some introductory comments. You are the author of Call Me Crazy, True Stories of the Mad Movement.
The subtitle is actually Stories from the Mad Movement.
Stories from the Mad Movement.
Yes.
That book came out in 1997 or earlier.
Yes, 1997.
That's right. Published here in Canada. A great book. For those of you who haven't, you should definitely read this book that Arit did. And Arit is an accomplished, very respected writer and an activist in the movement. So, and if I've missed something, please add something, Arit.
No, that's okay. I feel flattered enough. Thank you.
Okay. So I thought we'd talk a little bit, but perhaps briefly, before you got involved in anti-psychiatry, could you share with us maybe some of your personal experiences that radicalized you or politicized you?
Well, I was first incarcerated on a psych ward in 1978 when I was 20, and put on a ton of Haldol and kept there for many, many months.
Yeah.
And the second time was the following year. The first time was at the Seventh-day Adventist Branson Hospital in North York, and the second time was at Mount Sinai in downtown Toronto.
Mm.
And that was for even longer, and I believe I got locked up there in August of 79, and in June of 80, they sent me to a facility in the States on the pretext that there weren't enough activities for me at Mount Sinai, but actually because I was being a troublemaker, and I escaped from there in October of 1980, and I had very bad experiences, not so much in the States because that was a low security facility, but mostly because they didn't make me take any medications there. I had tapered off while I was at Mount Sinai, but I was horribly and always forcibly drugged for that long period of my youth, and it had quite a terrible effect on my memory and my morale. And
well, would you want to share just mention a few of the major effects of that forced drugging?
I had akathisia, I think it's called, where you can't keep still, and you're constantly restless, and then often in the hospital we get punished for that because we're not settling down. And I had dyskinesia right away also, with involuntary muscle spasms in various parts of my body. And
painful, I'm sure.
Horrible.
And yes, yes.
I was also in restraints a lot for resisting medication, and that was awful too. And I was dreadfully constipated, gained a lot of weight, and couldn't think, and just felt horrible mentally and physically and in every way imaginable. I was completely debilitated, as so many people have been and are still being.
Yes. Arit, what, if anything, did the doctors at Mount Sinai or the doctors tell you about the effects of the drugs or alternatives? I mean, we're talking about the neuroleptics, I guess, and perhaps some of the antidepressants.
The only thing they put me on while I was actually locked up there was neuroleptics and minor tranquilizers, so-called, the benzodiazepines. And I wasn't told anything about either alternatives or effects. All I was told was that I would have to take the neuroleptics for the rest of my life.
Really? For the rest of your life?
Well, that's standard, as you
yes,
know, Dawn.
I
for
know.
People to be told that.
Yes, yes. I remember.
Oh, still the case.
I know.
Yes.
I remember somebody, and on her own, said the doctor told her she would have to take lithium for the rest of her life. I said, this is absolutely a lie. And it's just more it's just more coercion. And
well, and of course, it greatly shortens, all of those drugs shorten people's lives. And last statistic I read was that people live 25 years less long who are on psychiatric drugs on average.
Yes, and there is research, as we both know, that clearly documents the shortening of lives when you're on psychiatric drugs.
Yes.
Now, you tried to resist, or you did resist, correct, while you were at Mount Sinai?
Yes.
And did they interpret that?
Of course they interpreted it in the standard way as standard. A lack of insight lack and of potential violence and so on.
Yes. And this is still going on. When anyone tries to resist, they see that as a symptom or more indication of psychosis or something.
That's right, and nothing has changed in this regard. And of course, women and men who have been sexually and physically abused are re-traumatized by the forced treatment and all of the procedures.
Right. You undoubtedly saw a hell of a lot that was going on with other sisters. Was anybody, or did you see anybody that was getting any support while they were locked up? Were there advocates or anybody from the community coming in?
No.
For example, to help you?
No, there wasn't anything like that. We got support. The patients got support from each other.
From each other. Right.
And everywhere I've ever been locked up, there's been one nice nurse who. Behaved like a human being, but it's not enough.
So you finally got out, and then did an awesome job.
I would just like to add one more thing, though.
Yeah.
At Mount Sinai, there was a very beautiful, very young woman. She was in her teens, and even younger than me, and I think she was about 16, and she was in there because she supposedly was mentally ill because she was traumatized because she was raped, and she got raped again by an orderly while she was in there, repeatedly.
She was put in there repeatedly?
Her problem in the first place had been that she was supposedly crazy because of the effect of a rape on her, and there was an orderly on our ward who raped her more than once while she was in there.
God. Yeah. I tell you. Well, I still remember the wonderful work you did as editor for Phoenix Rising. That happened a few years, of course, after you were released.
Yes, and thank you. It was wonderful working with you on it.
It was great stuff. We had the first anti-psychiatry. It still is the only anti-psychiatry magazine in Canada for 10 years.
Yes.
So tell me, maybe just briefly summarize.
I think so. Actually, we could also count the Second Opinion Society journal.
Oh,
I don't know if it's still coming out, but the SOS, the journal which in fact was called Second Opinion coming out of Whitehorse, was also certainly anti-psychiatry, but it wasn't a national publication.
Yeah. But briefly share with the listeners some of what did Phoenix, what was working with Phoenix, how did that help you? How did it empower you? In what way?
Oh, Phoenix empowered me enormously because I came into contact with many, many people who had suffered similar and much worse experiences than I had, and I had the opportunity to be useful by giving them the opportunity to tell their stories and communicate outside of where they were.
Yeah, well, you certainly reached out, and you managed to get a lot of wonderful stories. And by the way, I just want to remind the, I think I mentioned this to listeners here, that all of the 32 issues of Phoenix Rising from 1980 to 1990 are on PDF file on the web.
And so are wonderful and well worth looking at and reading.
It is. I just have to...
I don't say that because I edited it for a while.
Yeah, Psychiatric Survivor Archives, oneword.com, and you'll see it, psychiatricsurvivorarchives.com. And so tell us what you're still writing and offering support to a number of our sisters, I imagine.
I'm trying. I haven't been doing a lot of writing lately, although I hope to be again soon.
And I hope so.
Of course, people I know do get locked up still, and I have many times again, although not since 2007, but since moving to BC in 93, I've been locked up a bunch of times, and a friend of mine who I had hoped to be able to bring onto the show, and I hope to be able to do so in the future, is currently locked up on a psych ward in one of the suburbs of Vancouver. Mm. And what I see them doing to her is essentially no different than what was done to me both all those years ago and more recently. And she was on a short-term stay ward, and they were supposed to have had to let her go about a week ago, more than a week ago, and they didn't because she came back from a pass and had her lithium levels taken, and they weren't satisfied with how much lithium was in her blood. And so they've continued her incarceration, even though they're not supposed to keep people for more than a month.
They're not supposed to keep her for more than a month, and they're still keeping her?
Yes, and when she... before she had gone in, she had been taking 50 milligrams daily of Seroquel.
Of which?
Seroquel.
Seroquel, yes.
And when...
That's a neuroleptic.
Yes, it's a neuroleptic. I think it might also be called quetiapine or something like that.
Pardon?
I think its generic name might be quetiapine or something
like
that.
Yes, it's got quiet... included in its name for amazing quietapine or something
like that.
Yes,
I think it's
yes,
that
yes.
one. Anyway, it's a neuroleptic. It is very, very damaging, like all neuroleptics. Yeah. And as of the last time I talked to her, she was up to 600 milligrams. Uh-huh. And they have her on about five different other drugs as well. And it's having a very bad effect on her. I think that something that doesn't get talked about enough is that a lot of us have a paradoxical reaction to neuroleptic drugs, and whereas they're supposed to tranquilize us, they actually make our thoughts even wilder.
Yeah.
And I think that it certainly looked to me like that's what happened with her, and then they have the excuse to keep you in longer and keep raising the dose, so they just are blindly over-drugging this woman who didn't do anything wrong.
Is she getting any, I know you say you're visiting her. She is a good friend of yours. Is she getting any kind of legal support or anything from the community?
She applied for a review panel hearing. Are you there?
Yes.
She applied for a review panel hearing immediately upon being locked up, and then canceled it because it was going to be happening too soon, and she was getting more and more screwed up on the drugs. And then another hearing was scheduled, and I don't think it's happened. I've had to be out of town just now.
Right.
And I haven't spoken to her yet, but I know that she's having a pass for most of this weekend, so I hope she's back on the track for being
I hope she gets out very soon. Please give her our greetings from Toronto to her, and I hope she gets out.
I will, thank you. And I hope that sometime we can get her on the show, because she's very articulate about her experiences, and she's...
Great. Well, she is welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to have to wind this up, Irit. So, listen, thanks for taking this time to talk.
Thanks so much.
And please be well, and we'll be in touch, and a lot of good information that you've shared. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Don.
So take care of yourself.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks a lot. Okay. I was speaking with Irit Shimrat, a very good friend and former editor of Phoenix Rising, a writer very respected for her criticisms of the system. And she, a very courageous sister like so many. And you heard that it's mainly women, friends. It's mainly women that are targeted for drugs and electroshock. And certainly it's time to fight back much more, to organize, don't agonize, organize. And we're going to take, right, Mark, a break? Stay with us. Don't touch that dial. You're 88.1 FM, Anti-Psychiatry Radio on CKLN.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
There's no lines waiting there for us. We can bypass them all. There's no lines waiting there for us. We can move past them all. Get there faster if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
There's no time to think about ourselves. We gotta let it go, you see. There's no time to think about ourselves. Otherwise, we'll live in misery. We can get there if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
We can get there faster if we all
move together.
Well, it's time to open our hearts. It's time to let ourselves be free.
And you just heard Move Together by Ndidi Onukulo, and I hope I'm pronouncing the last name right. My apologies if I didn't. And yes, now as a wrap up, friends, as I said, this show is dedicated to all our sisters, psychiatric survivor sisters especially, and their supporters who are speaking out, breaking their silence, courageously fighting back against psychiatric oppression, psychiatric patriarchy, psychiatric sexism, psychiatric ableism, psychiatric homophobia, which has been exposed, but we have to continue the fight. And as long as until women especially get treated as equals, which they're still not in Toronto and across Canada and the world. They are sisters, human beings, and are special. Everybody is special. It's about time we had that view of each other. I want to end this special edition of Anti-Psychiatry Radio by listing a number of sisters, mostly Chuck, all psychiatric survivors who have been of particular help to me, whom I've worked with, and who've inspired me to continue to speak out, whether it's on radio or on the street or in my writing. Carla McCaig, Bonnie Burstow, Dr. Bonnie Burstow, Erit Shimrat, whom I just interviewed and you heard, Neera Fleischman, unfortunately not with us, who died many years ago, a brilliant editor. Connie Neal, shock survivor. I should have mentioned Carla McCaig also was a shock survivor and one of the leading mental health lawyers who taught a lot of lawyers to be more sensitive to psychiatric survivor. And Dr. Bonnie Burstow, who I've mentioned, is chair of the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault and one of the leading outstanding feminists and trauma specialists and on the faculty at OISE. Wendy Funk, shock survivor in the Yukon, who wrote a book that you should definitely read called What Difference Does It Make, about her personal experiences in the bin, in the psycho prison, and who is now become an accomplished pianist. Sue Clark, courageous shock survivor in Ottawa. Mary Maddock, another shock survivor who helped organize the Irish branch of Mind Freedom International in Ireland. Judy Chamberlain, another sister who unfortunately died a year ago, inspired an awful lot of us. Shirley Johnson, a shock survivor. Barbara Cody, a shock survivor, who died in Illinois a little while ago. And Elaine Grambois, who continues to be active in Montreal. So that is, again, a special tribute to these sisters, and I'm sure many others I didn't mention, who are in the forefront, in the vanguard, in the struggle to abolish this tyrannical, oppressive system, which has to go, just as electroshock and forced drugging have to go. So that is it, friends, and I want to say special thanks to our producer, yes, Susie Alvarez, and Shatila, and our outstanding technician there, Mark. I will be back, yes, the second Friday for another hour in April. So please stay tuned. Don't touch that dial. And be sure to listen to the special coverage of the march, the Women's Day March, which is happening tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., I think, is it for, anyway, starting at OISE and then ending up here at Ryerson at the Student Center. Take care. Speak up for your human rights and never remain silent about oppression, especially coming from psychiatry. See you again.